This is the Volleyball Coaching Wizards podcast, covering everything coaching, motivated and inspired by interviews and conversations with some of the world's great volleyball coaches. To learn more about the project, visit volleyballcoachingwizards.com. Now here are your hosts, John Foreman and Mark Levigeau.
Hey, welcome to episode 12 of the podcast. In this show, we use a quote from Joel Deering's interview in which he presents the idea of what he says is coaching to the performance rather than coaching to the score, focusing on how the team's performing and not necessarily what's going on in terms of points for or against. Joel spent 30 years coaching at the NCAA Division III level at Springfield College on the women's side, and also coached the men for 7 years, and he coached previously both men and women. He ranks in the top 10 in Division III with over 700 victories. His Springfield men's team was number one in the final Division III rankings during his last season. He was AVCA Regional Coach of the Year 5 times, coached 10 All-Americans, actually wrote a book about William G. Morgan, who was the inventor of volleyball. He's on the board of Volleyball Hall of Fame and has been a longtime member of the USA Volleyball CAP Coaches Accreditation Program, cadre. Having grown up and coached in the New England region at the beginning of my career, Joel was definitely one of the most respected coaches in that area, the northeast of the USA. So not only did what he say in his interview have a lot of interesting things and interesting value, but it gave Mark and I some pretty good stuff to talk about in this show. So hopefully you enjoy it.
So I tried to be very consistent in my approach and demanding in the sense that when a match started, I mean, again, we had specific performance objectives that were laid out. And I mean, at the end, with all the ways that we can gather data with data volley, I mean, you've got a lot of information in front of you during a match. And you can see right where you are, you know, with how we were keeping stats. And so to some degree, I mean, we might be up 10-7. I'm calling timeout because I got some data in front of me, and I'm like, look, we need to pay attention to something. Here's where we are in this set. Now, that's very demanding in that, you know, another coach might go, why are you breaking? You know, you're up 10-7. Why are you calling timeout? You know, because I'm coaching right now. This is, you know, I'm not coaching just for the scoreboard. I'm coaching for a performance.
Joel had a lot of interesting things to say in his interview, and we may talk about some of the other ones in a different episode. But this one about coaching to the performance and not to the scoreline was kind of one of those, man, that's just a perfect little catchphrase or snippet or soundbite, there's the word, soundbite, that reflects not necessarily the majority of coaches, but definitely tends to reflect coaches who have a teaching sort of mentality to them. And it also ties in with some other stuff that we haven't talked about in a podcast, but I'm sure we will at other times in terms of coaching to the level of your opposition. But we can, we'll leave that for a later lively debate. But I do like the idea that especially over the course of a long season, and I know in my situation in Sweden where there's such a developmental aspect to what I'm doing, that a lot of times it is looking to what are we actually doing versus what does the score say.
Yeah, it was a really interesting point about that, and I think that in the spirit, in the cauldron of competition, sometimes and coaches as well as anybody else gets caught up in the emotion, etc., of the score. And I think it's certainly an important reminder to remember that the score is not the key, but the performance. And I will admit, I have no problems admitting that I can do it the same way around. If the score is close and our performance is fine, or even if we're behind and our performance is good, then I very often see no reason to take a timeout, because why would I take a timeout to tell us that we're doing fine? So I definitely see the point in the opposite direction as well. But my assistant here tells the story because Joel, he specifically talked about taking a timeout at 10-7 up. And my assistant in a previous coaching job has had problems with his management, his administration, because of his timeout taking. And taking a timeout with the serve, for example, was considered I don't know how to describe this, a lack of quality as a coach. And
right.
You do things, good things for good reasons, working with the performance rather than the score or the serve. But it's not always interpreted in a good way from others. And as much as we don't want to admit it, that's one of the things that we have to deal with.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I've definitely been in situations where my team has been winning and it's clearly the better team, and I've called a timeout because they were just playing like absolute rubbish.
Yeah.
You know, I just got in their ear and told them this is not acceptable. This is not how we play our level of volleyball.
You know? Yes. I think that's the exact scenario that the Joel, in a slightly less aggressive way, John, talked about.
Jeez, aggressive. Wow. I was younger in those days. We learned things along the way. And even back then, nobody probably would have accused me of yelling at anybody. Although it is funny at times that somebody will say, you know, John yelled at the team the other day and I barely raised my voice, but by relative comparison, I suppose maybe it was yelling. But to getting back to your earlier point about, you know, kind of goofing as a coach and losing track of the performance side of things, because you're thinking too much of the score or the outcome. I had that happen to me just this past weekend where, you know, we're in a match against a team that we were shooting for a 3-0 win. It was going to be our first one since October, early October. And the team was really motivated to do that because, you know, as much as we lead the league in terms of points at the top of the table, we also lead the league in terms of sets played.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to maybe take a little bit of the pressure off of that. And I had an opportunity to get my backup setter in as a setter instead of just as a defensive substitute, which I normally do for her anyway.
Yeah.
And I got myself locked into a certain pattern of thinking and lost the opportunity because I was thinking I was going to use her in one way. And then I completely missed the chance to use her in a different fashion, still to get her in, you know, for a chance to set. Because, you know, my concentration was just too focused on where the score was or where we were in the rotation as opposed to where the opportunities were coming up.
That the point about being locked into a particular kind of thinking is one that you can use in, you know, a wider variety of circumstances. And it's, in a sense, it's the negative side of preparation. So the more you prepare, you prepare for every scenario, thing X happens, thing I would do Y, A happens, I'll do B. And, you know, if you're a good coach, you'll have if you're a very well-prepared coach, I should make the small, delicate distinction, you know, you'll have a list of what-ifs and your solutions. But if you are fixed with what your what ifs are, you can miss opportunities in a game. So you have one guy locked in as the blocking sub, but he also has a particular kind of serve that might work really well in one rotation. That just the way things drop out in the game, and you miss the chance to use him for that, or you're thinking about one player as a sub for this guy. And this actually happened to me on the weekend. I was preparing for, you know, a sense for one guy to his form to drop off. So I have the replacement for him that I then didn't use as a blocking or serving sub, even though he's a great at both, because I was saving him for something that in the end never happened. So preparation, is it like everything else, is a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Yeah, in my case, one of my desires going into that match was to get the offense more spread out, get some of the hitters who aren't getting as much of the ball more swings. And it happens to be the case that my second setter distributes the ball much more widely, although at times that's to her detriment because she shares the ball around when maybe she should be going at her, you know, getting the ball to her best hitter in the circumstance. Yeah. But in this case, that actually could have ended up being a good thing for us, whereas the starting setter was a little bit overly focused on our two strong hitters.
Yep.
So, you know, one of my middles only gets five swings, and my opposite only got nine. Okay. And, you know, upon reflection, John, you should have done something different with your substitutions.
Could have. You still won 3-0.
Yes, we did. And it ended up being 27-25 in the third set.
It's called chaos theory, John.
It's true. Yeah, well,
if you change any small thing, if that butterfly flaps its wings one more time, you might have a hurricane 1,000 kilometers away, but you also might not. Exactly. So,
yeah, you don't know the counterfactual. You know, I have no idea what would happen if I put my second setter in. Maybe that's that. Maybe, you know, maybe it was, you know, 11-6 up, or and we would have gone on and win 25-12. Who knows?
Yeah.
But from a developmental perspective, getting back to Joel's point, you know, at least I would have got the ball spread around a little bit more. At least I would have got the second setter some reps in an actual competitive environment.
Yeah.
Not just in training. So that's just one of those things. You file it away and go, okay, try not to make that mistake again in the future.
Can I give you a piece of can I give you some bad news?
You're going to make that same mistake again at some point? Is that what you're going to tell me?
Firstly, you're going to make a whole bunch of mistakes. But
that's a given.
Secondly, there's a pretty good chance you'll make exactly the same mistake again.
You're depressing me, Mark. You're depressing me.
I'm trying to help you prepare for an uncertain future.
See, okay, thanks.
Or actually for a certain future.
The certainty is that you're going to make lots of mistakes and you're probably going to repeat them. All right.
So while we're on that point, we might as well talk about it, because it's a question that I ask in some of the interviews and it relates to my experience and in being a lifelong learner and all the jargon stuff that you're supposed to say, and where I read the stories and read the books and by the great coaches, and I can remember really clearly just sitting reading a book and, you know, my shoulders dropping and saying, I'm never going to be as good a coach as this guy. I'm just never going to. I make too many mistakes. And I had a couple of moments when was actually two different Pep Guardiola books, and one was a story about Alex Ferguson and one was a story about Guardiola, and both of them, they talked about in detail about mistakes that they made, and Ferguson was a mistake about travel organization in his 40th year of being the best manager in the world, and the Guardiola one was was about someone who's renowned as a philosophical and a hard and has his way of playing the game, and how for an important match he'd let his players talk him into playing a different way. And both of those, they really stick with me, because I think they're massively important points, is that none of this is a science. And every coach, no matter how experienced, no matter what the level, they make mistakes, and they make obvious mistakes that you can't imagine that they would make. But the point is that Yes, they do. And yes, you will make those mistakes as well. And they are still good coaches, and there's no reason. And making a mistake doesn't mean that you're not a good coach. It's like everything. It's the response to the mistake that's important, that defines what happens next. And it's the same in a game of volleyball. It's the response to the mistake that decides whether you're going to be successful or not, the number of mistakes that you make.
Yeah, well, and the whole idea of looking at these people as paragons of excellence, it reminds me of when I was, just going through the PhD experience and mm-hmm. sitting in on seminars where we would bring in somebody who was presenting their paper to us, some external academic. And the professors and the faculty around me are asking questions and citing papers and, in so-and-so 2002, da 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 da. And I'm just sitting there looking at them going, how in the world can they possibly have all this stuff so readily available to them that they can pull it up in the middle of a seminar? And I was talking to my supervisor about this before I did my defense. And yeah. I said, if they start asking me for specific paper references, I'm not going to have them. Because my brain just is kind of like, what do I need right now? Not what was I thinking about 6 months ago?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I used to think the same way. She says, but then you realize that they're only citing papers that they were recently very looking at or critical to their own research that they're doing. It's not like they've got a list of 1,000 papers in their head that they can, reference at any specific time. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes more sense. So, unless you're inside, you never really know, kind of what's going on in the real mechanics of the things.
Exactly. Exactly. So, John, you will make a mistake with a substitution. You'll call a timeout at a wrong time or something like those. And what will decide the match is how you respond to it.
Right. And the tricky bit is sometimes you're not even going to know if you made a mistake or not. You might think you made a mistake, and maybe you did, or maybe you thought you did right and it was a mistake, but you just have no way of knowing for sure. The whole counterfactual thing we were talking about.
At the risk of destroying this whole project, maybe none of it matters at all. Maybe the coach is actually more or less irrelevant.
Haven't we kind of talked about that? Wasn't that sort of part of what Red Bad was talking about on match day?
I think that's the specific training philosophy that if you do a certain amount of work if you prepare the team correctly, then the coach doesn't need to work during the match. Although Redbud was the guy who said that the match is more important than the preparation.
Well, yeah, but he was looking at it more from the perspective of the coach can ruin a match.
Yes.
He's probably not going to do a lot to make the match better, but he can ruin the match if he doesn't do things, if he makes, some really egregious mistakes.
There's a great quote from Trapattoni, Giovanni Trapattoni, the football manager. He said a great coach can make a team 10% better or 5% better maybe, and a bad coach can make a team 70% worse.
Yeah, agreed.
There are more ways to screw up a team than there are to make them better.
Talk about depressing thoughts for the coaches out there. We're going to have a whole string of really paranoid coaches just sitting on the bench going, I just can't screw this up. I can't screw this up.
The good thing, though, is that all people think they're the exception. So none of our listeners will be thinking that they'll be thinking they're the other one.
All right.
Poor John and Mark having to go through those things.
I remember specifically going through it the first time I was a head coach going, man, I just need to make sure I put up the right lineup and let these guys play. Anything else would be me screwing this up because we're the best team here. I just got to get it right.
Yeah, I've definitely had those moments.
Yeah. We're veering a little bit away from what Joel was talking about, because obviously Joel was of the philosophy that, a coach does have an important role in a match situation. Although, to his point, it wasn't necessarily specifically about getting the result in that particular match. It was kind of more the long-term outcomes of continuing to be the teacher and the trainer under match conditions.
All fake cynicism aside, the coach does have a does play a role, and I don't think that it's always the role that that he or she thinks. And for example, we've talked before about timeouts and what their use is in terms of controlling game flow, but to manage performance, I think is a great one. Joel's point, just not the less the specific point, but about coaching for performance, actually reminded me of something from Vital Heinen's interview. And so Joel was talking about following the statistics on the bench and tracking performance in that way, and using the performance rather than the score to determine his response. And while Vital said that he didn't use statistics, it made me think about the point that he made about making substitutions before it comes up in the statistics. So I think if I remember rightly, his quote was something along the lines of, if a player has bad statistics, it means I've done a bad job because I didn't take him out well early enough. And I think that's a really good example of using performance rather than results, in a sense, to manage the team. And it although it's different, it did jump out at me at that moment that I listened to that that clip.
Well, and kind of on a related note, and I don't know about the specifics for Vital in terms of whether he's got the stats on hand readily.
He does.
But one of the things that Joel talked about was not having the stats in hand, that, you know, his bench was handling that.
Okay.
And your discussion with Axel, also you brought up the same idea where the head coach didn't have the stats in hand in order to be a little bit more connected with what was going on the court, leaving the actual, you know, statistics stuff to the bench for reference as needed.
Yeah, well, we have the possibility we use tablets during the game now, and I can, if I have the tablet, I literally have access to all of the statistics for the match, because I have the scout man who's doing it in real time. And I found that if I had the tablet in my hand, I wasn't just using it for the video to review the rally or parts of a rally that I might have needed. I was spending a lot of the time just searching stats. And for that reason, I don't actually use the tablet anymore.
Yeah, well, I've said before that I've realized that several different – every time I've tried having stats in hand or being involved with stats while I'm head coaching, I feel like I lose track of what's going on the court. But I can, you know, Guidetti talked about having the video and being able to watch the replays. That's something I can definitely see that being of value, because, you know, we have a restricted angle and there's always things that happen outside of what we can see from where we're standing.
Yeah.
You'd like to know, did that ball go outside the block? Did it go seam?
Yeah.
You know, where was the defender positioned? You know, was my block floating? Those sorts of things that if you were behind the court, you can see them. But, you know, if you happen to be on the wrong angle, forget it. You're not going to be able to pick that up.
Well, the new Data Volley versions, and this is not an advertisement, although I would endorse them if they asked me to, can actually replay the last five rallies. So not only can you review them, but in certain situations, you can show them to your team. Right. So you have now the possibility for in-game video with the team, and I've actually used that this season, which has worked quite well.
Yeah, feedback. And it also gives you the opportunity to do something that Tom Turco talks about in his interview, which is an upcoming one at the time we're doing this recording, which is to actually know what went on, not just what you thought went on. You know, you're just your own, as you would say, confirmation bias. You like, you know, one of your favorite terms. But yeah, it gives you a chance to see what actually happened as opposed to just whatever impression that you've developed. The thought yes. Happened. Same with the players, for that matter.
One of my favorite terms, so it's one of my least favorite things.
Fair enough. Okay, any final comments?
No. Again, other than to circle back to the point that as coaches, you know, it can be, it's also really helpful to our team if we focus on the performance, and maybe people talk about that as process, the process involved, that can firstly be a powerful tool for, you know, to increase the focus on the actual performance, and secondly can mean, you know, we're just doing a flat out better job in preparing our team.
Right. And I would add that for certain types of coaches who are maybe overly competitive, perhaps, it yes. might, you know, it might rein them in a bit, and they, you know, realize that it's, there's something beyond just whether or not they are winning and losing. And that gives them a chance to maybe mellow out a little and not be that coach on the sideline who's coaching a bunch of 12-year-olds and thinking he needs to win the championship every day.
Great point.
All right, we'll finish there.
All right.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. For show notes and more, visit volleyballcoachingwizards.com/podcast. Got an idea for a future episode or want to ask a question? Send an email to podcast@volleyballcoachingwizards.com.